Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting the film series Testigo Witness, Goya in the Movies. Held on select Fridays in May, each film touches upon artist Francisco de Goya's visions of the world, kicking off with Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro on May 10th at nortonsimon.org.
Support for LAist comes from Pasadena Water and Power. Every individual's actions matter in preserving resources. Join the Ripple Effect to build a more resilient water future. Learn more about water programs, workshops, and ways to save at pwpweb.com/the Ripple Effect.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Manto with critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com and Andy Klein, who reviews films for AV Club. First up, the romantic drama Challenger, set in the world of tennis, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. The film's directed by Luca Guadagnino. Tim, what do you think of Challengers?
Well, I like this movie. I like all of Luca's movies until I don't. and it usually there's always a moment when I don't. But this movie is this is filmmaking turned up to 11 in a genre that doesn't usually get that drama. Burton and Elizabeth Taylor back then. That's when you get those sort of scenes like that. So this movie we have that's set during one present day tennis match between these two guys, a present day tennis match. And over the arc of this tennis match, we're going to cover 13 years of the relationship between those two tennis players and the woman in the stand who's watching them both very closely, the exquisite Zendaya. And we're going to cut back and forth between that tennis match and everything that happens from the day that these three people met each other, those two boys, when they were junior tennis players on the ATP, and she was on the ATP. She was a star, blazing, getting ready to hit the world and eat some things up. And this narrative follows us through the relationship. You see that poster with her sitting on that bed and those two boys sitting on either side of her? We imagine we're going to get a certain kind of movie when we see that poster. And indeed, there's sex in this movie. But I'll tell you what, the sex in this movie is the tennis. That's the way Luca spends his time doing the sex. There's sex in the movie. Yeah, there's going to be this whole little relationship that goes on between them. But the sex is the tennis. It's a sassy movie directed with an incredible amount of energy. Everything gets a point of view. The film ramps and slows. The tennis ball during this match gets a point of view. Luca shoots from underneath the tennis court. I'm looking up. I see the stripe. I'm like, what is that? A lot of filmmaking here. And then these relationships. Zendaya is the thing, her character, who, again, when we meet her, she's the one that's going to make it. Luca cuts in that very first scene to this little tiny scar that's on her knee. And that tells you everything you need to know about what's going to happen to her. One of these boys is going to make it. The other one is not going to make it. They're very interesting people, all of these characters. They want her. She wants a winner. And if you're not going to be a winner, she's got no use for you. I love the power of Zendaya's character in this movie. I do not buy for a second the dynamic that Luca creates, along with his writer, in this movie in terms of the way this three-way situation works. I just don't believe it. I don't believe it for one second. But 13 years of this story, watching these really intense engagements between these three characters, that was a hoot. And that tennis match is just about bananas. I love that tennis match.
Challengers is the film, the romantic drama starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Luca Guadagnino is the director. Justin Kuritskis is the screenwriter. It's rated R and in wide release. By the way, the screenwriter is the husband of Past Lives writer-director Celine Song. Boy Kills World, a crime thriller starring Bill Skarsgård and Famke Janssen. Moritz Moore is the director and co-screenwriter of Boy Kills World. Andy?
This is an ultra-violent action film, as a warning right up front for people who don't handle that. Skarsgård plays Boy. He has no other name in the film. And he is being raised, it's in a not post-apocalyptic, but a dystopian future. He's being raised by this crazy shaman who is training him to be the assassin to take out the dictator, who is played by Famke Janssen. And the training is cruel in the way that we see frequently in Hong Kong films. It's really, you know, just like we'll bury you alive with just a straw to breathe through, all this stuff. And the film is told in voiceover. The boy is now deaf mute for reasons we don't find out until the end. But he narrates it using the voice of his favorite video game character, which is a very arch voice. I mean, it's really, it goes for laughs deliberately, and sometimes it's a little too much. The action is incredibly, it's incredibly fast, and a lot of CGI, a lot of, you know, good stunt work, but trick editing. And it was the kind of trick editing that I'm a little less sympathetic to, in that you don't really get that people are doing this stuff themselves.
Yeah. The score is a video game score. You know what it reminds me of? Andy and I were talking about this. In the early 90s, there was a game called Tekken. And Tekken 1, Tekken 2, Tekken 3. And at the beginning of Tekken would be, Challenger enters the ring. And the guy who's doing the voiceover sounds like that. Challenger 1, defeated. That kind of thing. That's what's going on in this kid's head, this man's head, as he's engaging all of these moments. And we keep hearing this voice in his head, and it talks like that. And it's really very, very, very funny. But it's kind of fun if you play Tekken. I played a lot of Tekken back in the day, and this is sort of shaped like that, with this sort of dramatic story at the center of it about a thing that happened to his family in the old, the sensei that's training
the shaman.
Yeah. And the only thing he's training for, boy kills world, he must kill the people who killed his family. That's all he's doing.
Okay, and I don't think this is a spoiler. I'll just say my biggest problem with the film is that there's a plot twist at the end that I found so totally implausible that it kind of invalidated a lot of what I had liked in the film previously.
Andy ruins the movie.
No. I didn't say what the plot twist was.
We're talking about Boy Kills World, the crime thriller in wide release. It's rated R. Egoist, a Japanese drama which stars Ryoe Suzuki. It's directed by Daishi Matsunaga, who also co-wrote the screenplay. Egoist, Tim.
This is just a beautiful, beautiful movie. The characters in this movie are just so wonderfully ordinary. This young man, a friend that he meets, and that young man's mother. But it all sort of comes together to build this story about these relationships that's not ordinary at all. It's deeply, deeply moving. We have this young man, Kosuke. He's about 30. And we find out that when he was 14 or so, his mother died. He lived out in this rural area, and he was a young gay man, and it was very difficult. And then he pulls himself together and builds himself into this very particular kind of person. He dresses impeccably. He's an editor at a very important magazine in Tokyo. He's very sophisticated, very well educated. He hires a young trainer, about 5 or 10 years younger than him. Not nearly as sophisticated as him. Also gay. They begin this relationship. The young trainer has this mother whom he adores and is taking care of. And so he starts to bring his friend over, and his friend starts to get involved in that relationship. And then a very dramatic thing happens. And we watch the rest of this movie, this young guy and what he does. And it just becomes this incredibly, incredibly beautiful movie that completely resets the way he understands the world and what kind of a human he wants to be and what matters in the world. And none of it is what he thought it was. None of it is what he thought it was. So the beautiful scene at the end of this movie, it kind of reminds me of the scene at the end of that movie we were just talking about. Not Past Lives. There was a wonderful movie last year where the guy is sitting in the car.
It was the Wim Wenders film.
There's a movie, this movie reminds me of that movie, and there's a scene in this movie that's reminiscent of that last scene. Yeah. Just beautiful.
Perfect Days. Great film.
Perfect Days.
And just a great scene. Kind of, I was thinking about and driving away, like in Jackie Brown, the end of Jackie Brown. Yeah. And you see all the emotion on her face as well. We're talking about the film Egoist, a Japanese drama. Andy, what do you think?
I liked this. At first, I thought it was going to be, in its low-key style, that it was going to be like an Ozu film, except with hot gay sex, which there's quite a bit of in the first 20 minutes or half hour. But once it finds its way in the relationship, you really do see this guy developing, and even through the bad things that happen eventually, it is watching him, an adult. I mean, I don't. I think he's more than 10 years older than the boy
35-ish or something, yeah.
But really becoming an adult after having had this kind of frivolous lifestyle. And it's very, very touching that way.
We're talking about Egoist is the film. It's directed by Daishi Matsunaga, who co-wrote the screenplay. It's unrated, the film in Japanese with English subtitles. And you can see it at Lemley's Monica Theater in Santa Monica. Bad Faith is a documentary about Christian nationalism. The film is directed by Stephen Ulaki and Christopher Jacob Jones. Andy?
Wow, could this not be any timelier than it is? This is about Christian nationalism, and it's a deep dive into the roots, beginning back, I guess, in the Reagan administration and the Republican Party strategy enlist the evangelical Christian base. But it also goes into the way in which rich oil magnates like the Koch brothers and others were hand in glove with this, not that they care about faith in of any kind, but because if they can get their guy in, they can get huge tax breaks for their oil companies. And so they fund this huge network, basically masterminded by a guy named Paul Weyrich, who is evil incarnate. And you get a lot of very good analysis of how this developed. And it is, you know, it's an issue that is going to be an issue in the upcoming election. I mean, it just is a very insightful look at how the Republican Party got co-opted the evangelical base and then got co-opted by the evangelical base and the symbiosis there that, you know, leads to Donald Trump.
Bad Faith, the documentary. What did you think, Tim?
Well, this is absolutely fantastic over on Apple Plus, if I'm not mistaken. It's where it's going to be. People should check it out. Paul, 1942 to 2008. You know, political folks who were paying attention in the early 80s. You saw Paul all the time standing next to Ronald Reagan and Jerry Falwell and others. Paul also shows up in the documentary The Power of Nightmares about 2004 with God on Our Side, The Rise of the American Right about 1996. The interesting thing about Paul, that as a public figure, he has been standing in front of microphones and cameras saying all of these things for 45 years, 50 years, Paul. They call this thing a secret, it's not a secret conspiracy. These people have been engaged in this business for 50 years. They're very, very specific about it. He was a theocratic zealot whose notions about leadership in America are basically no different in terms of structure anyway than those of the Ayatollahs of Iran, just based on a different book. But that's the way, and they say it all the time. These people say these things, and by these people, I mean the very specific evangelical churches we're talking about, include Jerry Falwell's and Pat Robertson's and Mike Huckabee's and a few other, all of whom are connected to the Republican Party. What's strong about this doc, though, is this is filmmaking that does have a perspective, but it's a filmmaking that allows these folks, with their words, their documents, their manifestos, to frame what they believe and what they want. This filmmaking lets them say it. they're talking heads in the film, but the talking heads, generally speaking, just kind of repeat the things. This guy said this, and then we cut to that guy saying that. So there's no way to take this and say, well, this is just this is very sharp. It's very specific, and these people say things like this. I do not believe in democracy. I do not want everyone to vote or to have a vote. I don't believe in feminism. They say these things out loud in front of thousands of people on tape and on camera. And it works its way right up to January. If you're paying attention, all this doc does is say, pay attention.
We're talking about the documentary Bad Faith that's available on demand, directed by Stephen Ulaki and Christopher Jacob Jones. It's unrated, again, available for home viewing. Also want to invite you to join us for our Film Week screening series. It resumes at Vidiot's in Eagle Rock coming up on Saturday, May 11th. Double Indemnity, the classic film starring Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray, Billy Wilder directing. We're going to see it on the big screen at Vidiot's in Glendale Saturday night, May 11th, starting at 6:30. We have a great post-film panel to join us for that, including our Film Week critic Claudia Puig and the authors of a new Turner Classic Movie book about Double Indemnity. Get your tickets now at las.com/events. More to come on Film Week. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Andy Klein and Tim Cogshell. Up next are two documentaries on photography. The first, Uncropped, directed by D.W. Young, takes a look at the iconic images of New Yorkers and celebrities, as recounted by photojournalist James Hamilton. Andy, what did you think of Uncropped?
Absolutely terrific. It's really two films in one. It is about his photography, and we see these gorgeous, mostly black and white images. He prefers black and white, very contrasty looking stuff. And he is the, you know, he's one of those guys who just captures the moment that somebody else isn't going to see, as well as doing a whole lot of celebrity photography. But even then, his stuff is different. At the same time, this film is really about the decline of print media. He started his career in the late 60s, around the same time I started doing journalism. He was at the Village Voice for a long time, and the film makes you realize how important, how influential the Village Voice was. Essentially, the entire alt newspaper universe developed from the Village Voice, and you see as economics and computers and eventually the internet just totally erodes the existence of those papers, as we've seen here in L.A. with, you know, with The Reader and The Weekly and everything.
Yeah, The Weekly and all, right.
And so for me, this was very personal because
You worked at several of those papers.
I basically, you know, it's talking about the strain of journalism that I was working in, and you just see, you know, he manages to thrive anyway. But what you see is a free press that has diminished substantially, you know, while larger outlets are being more consolidated, all of that stuff. It's very sad that way, but his work is really transcendent and carries it.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the documentary Uncropped on the work of photojournalist James Hamilton. Tim?
Uncropped because over the arc of the many, many publications that James worked for, he was one of the few photographers who never had a picture cropped. Photojournalist, no photo editor ever looked at one of his photos and said, nah, we got to cut something out because James didn't take those pictures. And the Herald and Harper's Bazaar and that Voice and the New York Observer and Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair and so on and so forth, James Hamilton. Yet, to be honest with you, James Hamilton isn't a very well-known photographer other than within the confines of this
world.
I
had not heard his name.
I knew his pictures only because but you got to be in there. Or you wouldn't know. I like Richard Avedon, his contemporaries, Richard Avedon, Diane Arbus.
Who are famous figures.
Very, very famous. Annie Leibovitz. And his work, of course, in every... Now, one of the things that he did, he moved around genres. Fashion photography, I think, is where he started. Brilliant stuff. Then a wee bit of time as a war photographer, wee bit of time as just a city photographer. All of that, I think, is one of the reasons. Plus, he was not a self-promoting. He is this quiet, unassuming person that everyone simply loved to have around. And then, as it happens, he's a genius. Not only a brilliant photographer, knows everything there is to know about movies, cinema.
Yes.
I mean, like, in these this stumps, weird sort of depth.
He stumps Peter Bogdanovich on a cinema question.
Wow.
Becomes Wes Anderson's, first George Romero, and then Wes Anderson's set photographer. mostly because Wes Anderson felt like it was taking a master's class, and because he was a brilliant photographer. Who's in this film? David Lee, Spike Lee's little brother, who is Spike Lee's set photographer and a wonderful photographer, too. Some of the very important writers that he was taking photography pictures with on these stories, talking about how brilliant he was and how his large format photography was just not seen before. He has he works in a strain of photography that goes back to Ouija. Yes. Ouija used to take those high key kind of
which he acknowledges.
Yeah. And that's what he's doing. And he's you know, 2 years at Pratt. Man, that's a good education. He only did 2 years. He dropped out and had a life instead.
Clearly learned what he needed to learn.
And then I'll just quickly say, and then Jared Kushner comes in and buys the New York Observer and ruins it.
Yeah. Uncropped is the documentary. D.W. Young, the director, takes a look at the remarkable images shot by photojournalist James Hamilton. Uncropped is at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Our second documentary on photography is titled Photographic Justice, The Corky Lee Story. It's directed by Jennifer Takaki. Tim?
So at the exact same time that James is over in Manhattan and very doing that, Corky is over in Chinatown in Brooklyn. Same time. Corky was born in, I think, 47. Doing his thing, photographing the Asian communities, not just there, but all of the Chinatowns all over the country. Excuse me. He took pictures. Now, what he was taking pictures of was a very different thing. He was taking pictures of protest and of anguish and of strife of the Asian diaspora all over the streets. Very important photography that you know as well. And you haven't heard of him either. But James is in his documentary, and Corky is in this documentary. They're both breathtaking. They're both full of images. Corky's story ends in 2021 when he passes away from COVID. That's in this movie. And it's very important. But the way the film is constructed, that's just a terrible mistake, the way they constructed this film, because you'll leave people out. No, people need to know how Corky lived and how he died. Watch this movie. You will get the experience of the entire Asian American diaspora and of a brilliant photographer who went unknown for far, far, far too long.
We're talking about Photographic Justice, The Corky Lee Stories. His work was 50 years, his career, documenting different Asian American communities. Jennifer Takaki is the director, was shown at the LA Asian Pacific Film Festival, and you'll be able to see it at Lemley's Glendale Theater in Glendale. And then next month, starting in the middle of May, it'll be available on PBS. Photographic Justice, The Corky Lee Story. The documentary Little Empty Boxes is directed by Chris Newhard and Max Le Guevar. Andy, what'd you think of Little Empty Boxes?
I thought this was quite good. It's the filmmaker is documenting his mother's descent into dementia. It doesn't feel exploitative that way, which was my first worry going into it. We see earlier, you know, we see home videos from when he was a little kid and she's this beautiful young woman and everybody's happy, things are good. But now she's only 63 and she's losing it. She's got Parkinson's and is tentatively diagnosed with Lewy body dementia, though there seems to be some question on the diagnosis in the film. It's heartbreaking when you see him trying to communicate and she just can't at times. And then actually late in the film, there is an uptick. It seems like they change her diet. The film makes a sidetracks into a scientific discussion of the American diet and how it sets up dementia very, very early, and essentially blames carbs rather than fat, says that the whole thing about cholesterol and fat and heart disease is bogus. And it really has been the fact that we eat way too much carbs and it distorts the brain. So they change her diet and it seems to be helping her pick up a little bit and get a little cognition back. At the end, there is, you know, a crawl at the end about, you know, when she died. I mean, the film mostly takes place back, you know, eight and 10 years ago. So It's sad at the end, but you do see some sign of hope there. I mean, her upturn right before the crawl is really uplifting.
We're talking about the documentary Little Empty Boxes. It's at Lemley's Monica Theater in Santa Monica and the Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Humane is a horror film starring Jay Baruchel and Emily Hampshire, Peter Gallagher in the cast. Caitlin Cronenberg, daughter of David Cronenberg, makes her directorial debut with Humane. Tim.
David's kids, man. Those apples fell right at the bottom of the tree. Right at the tree. Maybe yep. On the tree. those apples there. This horror movie. Sharply socially pointed horror movie in a not too distant future. Things have gotten so bad in the world that many governments of the world have taken up this euthanasia program. People can decide to, you know, tap out, and their family members will get, you know, money or whatever it is that they're going to get, you know, in order to bring the population down. Generally speaking, though, what's happening is that poor people, people of less means are doing this. Older people, sick people, all this kind of stuff.
They're getting compensated for giving up their lives and cutting population.
So that's what's going on. A very famous news anchor who's recently retired, Peter Gallagher's character, who actually doesn't really care for the notion of all of this, but he wants to prove that the well-to-do, the powerful are engaged in the program too. So he signs himself and his wife up for the program. And then we have this family drama as his family comes to the family home and they're going to talk about what dad is planning on doing. Now, somehow, out of all of that, we end up in a comedic horror movie, a very funny horror movie. With all kinds of blood and horror. And I suppose that's okay. I enjoy it.
It's like early Peter Jackson kind of comedic horror.
It is almost like that. I mean, the gore is excessive at times. And you have the government functionary who is this guy who looks like Don Rickles, who is just like, these are the rules. You got to follow the rules. And the rules have, it turns out, there's lots of fine print in this agreement to give up your life that nobody ever read, which, of course, we all read everything in all of our agreements on software. It really does get funny, and it manages to figure a way to work out the plot without totally ticking us off by the end. A little bit contrived at the end, but I was so relieved by the contrivance that it made it more satisfying.
We're talking about the film Humane, directed by Caitlin Cronenberg, written by Michael Spiraga. It's rated R, and you can see it at the Alamo Drafthouse in downtown Los Angeles. Alam is written and directed by Ferris Khoury. Tim?
Yeah, this film is beautiful. It begins with these Palestinian boys, teenagers, and they're sitting around talking about their relationship with girls and trying to do it in this sort of pious kind of way. Well, do you make a move on a girl if she has a brother? Well, how old is her brother? He's about 9. Sure, you can make a move. He's not going to know. that kind of stuff. Well, what about her father? All girls have fathers. That doesn't. So this is the kind of thing. Boys talking like this. Now, these boys are Palestinian, but they're also Israeli. They're Israeli Arabs. And they go to this high school. And on this high school, there's this Israeli flag, Alam. I thought I knew what Alam meant, but apparently it has several different meanings depending on how you say it and where you put the accent, you know, assalamu alaikum and all this kind of peace be on the world, the universe. It can also mean the flag. In a certain context. And the different boys, kids in the school have issues. Now, all of this takes place well before the events. This was written. This was film of October last. So these things have been issues round and about. What happens in this movie is extremely powerful, but not particularly vicious or bloody. And interestingly, most of the antagonism is between various different Palestinians. Their teachers at the high school are Palestinian, Arab as well. And that's who they are engaging with about the way they are being treated, these young people. There's this one really angry young man and this other very stoic young man. And then, of course, there's this insanely beautiful young girl who comes into the film between. The movie is this little triangle of a love story. It is high school kids, but in the middle of it, you can't help but see this gigantic issue. And things are going to happen. It's not a recitation of anything from October or anything that's going on now. But I think it bears in stark relief a little bit of an understanding of how these things look just to these people, 16, 17, 15 years old. I thought it was very, very strong. And these performances, these young people, man, these kids can act.
The actors are Mahmoud Bakri, Sareen Kass, and Mohammed Karak. The film's written and directed by Firas Khoury. Alam is in Arabic, Hebrew, and Hebrew with English subtitles, and it's available on demand. Infested is a French horror film that's directed by Sebastian Vanacek. Andy.
This takes place almost entirely in a high-rise apartment building where the hero, Caleb, in his bedroom has a collection of reptiles and bugs of various kinds, including lots of endangered species. He buys a spider. He buys the wrong spider. Ooh. And the spider gets out. And in a real breach of reality, this spider manages to reproduce into tens of thousands of spiders within like 24 hours. The entire apartment building is filled with it, and people are getting stung and killed. And it's not so much gore. There's a little bit of gore, but it's mostly icky and creepy and pretty effective.
Infested, a French horror film. It's rated R, and you can see it on the Shudder streaming service. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we talk about the anniversary of the great Japanese film Seven Samurai from Akira Kurosawa. We'll be talking about how influential that film is when we come back in just 90 seconds.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.